7-passenger Acura MDX with electronic four-wheel drive. Information at Acura.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thinking back on the harsh reality of war is not easy for the families of soldiers who have fought in battle or for the veterans who survived and live with haunting images of their falling comrades. This Veterans Day, we're tapping the memories of particular men, fathers, and their own sons who fought in World War II and Vietnam, and we'll hear their views on the war in Iraq. Tonight on Point, Remembrance of War. We begin on the home front, where a new generation of American families is facing the loss of sons and daughters, fathers and mothers. In the 6 months since President Bush declared an end to major combat operations in Iraq, American soldiers have been killed at a rate of more than one a day. Jeffrey Gettleman is a reporter with the New York Times and has been following the return of soldiers killed in Iraq. I asked him if there's a pattern to how the military and soldiers' families are coping with the mounting losses.
One thing I've noticed is how ritualized these deaths are. In the Army, there's sort of a ritual for everything. There's a way to make your bed. There's a way to pivot on your foot. There's a way to fold a plastic bag. And with death, we see the same sort of formalized, ritualized way to handle this. It starts with the notification. The notification is a very formal, specific script in which an officer is supposed to go to the door of a family, knock on the door, not say anything until he's inside the house, and then standing, he's supposed to deliver what really is a script that starts, "The Secretary of the Army has asked me to express his deep regret that your husband, daughter, son, whoever it is, was killed in action," and then he begins to talk to the family a little more informally and tell them exactly what happened. From there, the Army then has sort of a checklist of what the family needs to do to prepare for the funeral and the body being brought back and all the different arrangements. I've been to a couple military funerals, and you notice the same sort of rituals unfolding there, the way that an officer will get down on a knee and present the family with a Bronze Star or a Purple Heart or some other medal that the soldier has won, the way the flag is folded into this really tight triangle by these white-gloved honor guards that stand extremely rigid, almost as if they're made out of bronze, and meticulously fold this flag and present it to the family. And then at the end, of course, you hear taps. You could say it's formulaic, but it's also just very patterned and very formal. And even if there's a huge difference among rank or age of the soldier, it often sort of plays out the same way.
Jeffrey, take us in to some of the stories of the particular soldiers, their deaths, and what you've seen about how families are responding.
One of the soldiers we covered was a paratrooper named P.J. Johnson. He's 29 years old. He was a real gung-ho paratrooper from Fayetteville, North Carolina, and he had always wanted to be in the Army. And it's interesting. We've heard this from a few different families about how sort of excited and satisfied some of these soldiers were to be doing what they were doing.
You write in the case of PJ about how he had once fought a battle in Afghanistan in a flak jacket and boxer shorts. Tell us what he was doing and how he died in Iraq.
PJ was a paratrooper, and he had been delivering school supplies to a school in Fallujah on October 20th. And according to the family, because often the family is the best provider of information about what actually happened as far as the details, PJ and his men, he was a sergeant, had gotten out of their Humvee, had delivered some boxes of school supplies to a school, and in that short time from when they got out of their car, dropped off their boxes, and got back in their car, somebody had planted an explosive underneath their Humvee, so as soon as they got back in and started it up, the car exploded. And PJ was instantly killed and burned really badly. And his wife, Missy Johnson, who's very stoic and strong,
lives in Fayetteville, North Carolina.
She lives right near Fort Bragg, where PJ was based with the 82nd Airborne, mm-hmm. Told us, you know, exactly what she was doing, how she was studying for a test. She got a knock on the door. It was toward the evening, late afternoon. She was in her pajamas. She had no idea who it was. And the moment that she opened that door, her heart just seized because she saw three people standing there, full Class A uniform, which is the dress greens, and she knew immediately what they were going to tell her.
You tell stories of neighbors collecting gas money for relatives to get to bases and funerals. The story from Montpelier, Virginia, of the parents of Captain John Teal. Could you share that with us, Jeffrey?
Yeah, that was a really moving scene. Captain John Teal, 31 years old, was a medical officer staffed with the 2nd Brigade, 4th Infantry Division, which is based out of Fort Hood, and they had been operating in Baqwaba, which is northeast of Baghdad. His specific duties were to help supply field hospitals and things like that, but because there wasn't such a need for that, he had been most recently working with Iraqi town councils, because supposedly Captain Teal was a very friendly, easygoing guy and quickly won the trust of locals. On October 23rd, he was riding in a convoy that he had volunteered to lead because he knew where these people were, and they hit one of these roadside bombs, which seemed to be taking a toll on a number of troops, and he was instantly killed. I met with his parents the day that his body was supposed to be shipped back to their town, to the funeral home where they live in Montpelier, Virginia, and they were just sitting in the living room. The sun was going down. They were telling stories about their son. They were showing pictures. And there was like this sense of this vigil, how they were waiting for their son to finally come home. And the parents were really divided about what to do with his remains.
There was a terrible moment of tension that you describe, the exchange between this longtime husband and wife, Jeffrey.
Yeah, Miss Teal was saying, you know, I hope they fix him up good. Army officers had told the Teals that their son got the full blast of the explosion. And Mrs. Teal says, I hope they fix him up good. And Mr. Teal, you know, responds, no, no, no. You know, what's in that casket is a cold, damp piece of shell, were his words. And then she says, well, maybe they can just crack the lid so I can hold his hand. And he just exploded and said, damn it, honey, that's not him. That's not the person who walked out of here. That's not John Robert.
And she said, okay, okay, and then later he softened and came to her side. Jeffrey Gettleman, we thank you for collecting these stories and for sharing them with us. I hope we can check in with you again.
Thank you very much.
Jeffrey Gettleman is a reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with us from Atlanta. On this Veterans Day, American troops on the ground in Iraq struggle to bring security to a country still racked with uncertainty. With car bombs and sniper attacks, missile fire and ambushes, news of casualties filters back in news reports of one or, on bad days, a dozen soldiers at a time wounded and worse. Flag-draped coffins arrive quietly at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware, a steady testament to the human cost of war. There's also pride and sacrifice to remember, and the distinctive emotions that each war leaves alongside its dead. Our guest tonight, Michael Takeff, the son of a World War II veteran, has gathered the stories of American fathers who served in World War II and their sons who served in Vietnam. Tonight on Point, we talk with Michael Takeff and the veterans themselves about their wars and this war, the war in Iraq. Joining me now from New York is Michael Takeff, author of the new book, Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, American Fathers and Sons in World War II and Vietnam. Good evening and welcome, Michael Takeff.
Thank you.
Michael Takeff, I wonder what it was that brought you to write this particular book. Why write about veterans and why write about these fathers and sons?
As you said, my father was a World War II veteran. He served in Europe. And he spoke about the war quite a bit, but it was only at the very end of his life, just a few weeks before he died in 1992, that he let on as to how much it really meant to him. He said in a hospital room where I was sitting talking to him, he called the war the high point of his life. And in the months and years after his passing, I chewed on that comment, and it got me to wondering about the place of war in the lives of the people who have fought in war. And what I found in speaking with the veterans of World War II and Vietnam, these fathers and sons, is that war really is a pivotal time in people's lives. And what's so fascinating, really, is to listen to their eloquent testimony and to see not only how people live through war, but also how they live with war in the years and decades that follow, because they don't let it go.
What you've really compiled here in Brave Men, Gentle Heroes is a kind of oral history, the words of the veterans themselves. Did you choose Vietnam and World War II because of the great contrast in which they stand in the kind of national mythology of war, or because these were the veterans who were at an age when you could capture fathers and sons alive and together?
Well, first of all, it was important to do this book now because World War II veterans, as most people know, are dying at the rate of over 1,000 a day. But I think these two wars really in the popular imagination, they set one another off. Each one really was the defining experience of a generation. And we look back at the two wars and we put them into neat categories. There's World War II, the good war, the war fought and supported by a unified population, the war we won. And then there's Vietnam, the bad war, the war we lost, the war that tore this country apart. What is so fascinating is to speak with these fathers and sons, to listen to what they have to say, to dig under the surface of those preconceptions, and then to find these common threads that run through the experiences of human beings in war, the idealism, the strong commitment to serving their fellow Americans in time of need, patriotism, great courage under fire, great feeling for comrades, and of course, a sense of the horror of combat. This is something that the rest of us who are lucky enough to have been spared that horror don't really understand. These people do understand, and there's this brotherhood among them. I think one reason I was motivated to hear these stories is that normally men don't talk about their experiences. Combat veterans in particular, I think that all of us know people, relatives, fathers, grandfathers in particular, who have been to war but don't share those experiences. That's why I like to say that the eloquent testimony of these men in Brave Men, Gentle Heroes provide the stories that your father never told you.
The national stereotype is of these two generations is very different. Did you find these fathers and sons, veterans of World War II and Vietnam, speaking with or to or at each other across a canyon? Were they divided by the different texture, the different quality of the two wars? Or was the experience of having been in war itself more unifying than whatever differences the wars presented?
I'd have to say it is more unifying. Frequently, when the sons came home from war, the fathers and sons still did not share their experiences. Nonetheless, many men said there's a bond there. There's a bond of having been in combat, even if it's an unspoken bond. Among the fathers and sons who have shared, it's brought them so much closer together in a way that they're both Army buddies and a father and son. The Tarbells are a great example of upstate New York, members of the Mohawk Indian tribe. Al Tarbell, who served with the 82nd Airborne in Europe, was all over Holland, France, Germany, Belgium, came back and would tell people about what he had seen, what he had done, and people didn't believe him. They didn't want to know. He had nightmares for many years. His son Mike went off to Vietnam. He did three tours there. And when he came back, Al could see what was going on inside of Mike. Mike wasn't talking, and Al could see that he needed to let go. He needed to express his emotions over these extraordinary events he'd experienced. In time, Al got Mike to open up. And then the experience, this bond between them, helped Al open up too, the two of them together. And what Al says now is he says, it makes me feel good to talk to him because I know he understands.
Michael Takeoff, who did you find can speak more easily about their war experiences half century and maybe 30 years on from World War II and Vietnam? Veterans of which war?
I don't think I would distinguish it that way. Some people can speak easily, and for some it takes some coaxing. I will say that when people do start speaking, there is so much there. All you really need to do is sit down and listen. And so much will spill out. And the emotions are so vivid and deep and so surprising. If I can tell you, one of the most moving experiences I had in compiling this book was among the first interviews I conducted with a gentleman named Jim Coyne Sr. Jim Coyne he's passed away since, was a retired telephone technician, originally from Jersey City, New Jersey. When I met him, he was confined to a wheelchair, suffering from mid-stage Alzheimer's. Really didn't know what was going on in the room around him. But he remembered with precision and great wealth of detail the confusion and the fear the day he landed on the beach at Sicily 57 years before in 1943. Toward the end of the interview, I asked him, I said, Mr. Coyne, do you think about the war much anymore? And he said, no. And I looked down at my notes to try to come up with another question. And before I could, he said, but every night when I'm in bed, first I bless myself, then I bless the men and boys who didn't make it. And he showed me. He said, I cross myself, then I cross myself again, and I say, for those who are left behind.
All those years later. On this Veterans Day, we're talking with Michael Takeoff. He's author of Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, American Fathers and Sons in World War II in Vietnam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight on this Veterans Day with author Michael Takeiff. He's written a new book, Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, American Fathers and Sons in World War II and Vietnam, essentially an oral history of testimony from men and their sons who served in those two wars. It's quite a juxtaposition. Michael Takeiff, one thing that you point out, and it comes as a cognitive surprise, even though we should know it, and is that these wars were only 20 years apart, and that when Vietnam began, it was the images of World War II that still dominated the national consciousness in most dimensions of what war was.
Absolutely. The decision to go to war in Vietnam was greatly influenced by the experience in World War II. It was called Munich Syndrome. And we saw this recently with the war in Iraq. The idea that we didn't stop Hitler in time, well, now here we could stop the communists before they got any farther. But more than that, it influenced the kind of war that the soldiers themselves expected when they got over there. People went over to Vietnam, these idealistic young men, expecting a war much like what their fathers had fought, just, apparently well-commanded, with a clear objective and a well-defined rationale. When they got there, the reality made it was very painful to accept. Paul Keith is a great example. Paul Keith from Boston, Massachusetts. Paul believed in what he was about to do when he went to Vietnam. He got there. The very first day he arrived, the first day, he was at an in-country orientation, and the senior non-commissioned officer giving the orientation said, forget all that stuff you've heard about saving your country from communism, about bringing democracy to the South Vietnamese. You are here to save yourself, save your buddies, and get home. The idealism, the courage of these brave young men really was abused by our leaders, and I think it's so important that we not let that happen again.
In Iraq, perhaps. How did you find, then, the experience of talking to veterans of the two wars at the turn of a new century? Was the tone very different? Did you have World War II veterans who were still wrapped in the flag and the correctness and the glory of their war, Vietnam veterans wrapped in bitterness, or not?
Vietnam veterans and World War II veterans both do take pride in their service, and they both, most of them still believe in the concept of national service and in specifically the concept of military service and its importance. Of course, the difference is that Vietnam veterans do not take pride in the war itself. They all have reason to be dissatisfied and bitter and discontented with what happened. There are two main schools of thought, of course. There's the we never should have been there school, and then there's the other school that says we never should have fought a war that the politicians wouldn't let us win. The World War II veterans do look back on the purpose of their war and its achievement with great pride. But I should add that, again, there is this thread that runs through. When people fight, as Greg Camp told me, Greg Camp is a Vietnam veteran who went to West Point, they don't really fight for flag and country. They fight for the guy to the right of them and the guy to the left of them. Or as Al Tarbell said, I asked him, what were you fighting for? And he said, well, I really just wanted to go home. I wanted to be someplace warm. I wanted to put my feet up and have a beer. Then, right around VE Day, his outfit liberated a concentration camp, and they said, oh, now we know why we were fighting.
Did the men you talked to feel wounded years later, or proud, both? Did they carry their veteran status as a burden or as a point of pride?
Well, I think they do carry it as a point of pride, but it is a burden. And we are used to the concept of Vietnam veterans carrying around this burden. And most of us think that World War II veterans came home. They won. They came home to an adoring nation. They built successful lives as husbands, fathers. They built this magnificent economic engine that the United States became. But Al Tarbell had nightmares for decades. Walter Krauss, a submariner during the Second World War. In early 1942, he was on a submarine that was almost sunk. It was submerged at a steep up angle. The compartment where he was filling up with water. Of course, he survived, but he still has nightmares to this day, 61 years later. And he says, every night when I dream about this, or whenever I dream about this, I'm just about to drown, and that's when I wake up. So they do take pride in it, but it is something that is not easy to carry around with them, not by any means.
You write that all the veterans, whatever their experience, knew that behind the parades and fanfare, war really is about kill or be killed.
Yes, it is. Most of us who have not been there, I have not, don't understand this about war. We tend to think of war as divisions and battalions and generals and strategy and maps. Well, sure, it's all that. But underneath it all is war's basic building block. Two people, each one trying to kill the other before the other kills him. Veterans know this. People who have been to combat know this. People like Steve Krause, a Vietnam Marine. Here's how he describes one battle in which he was involved. You're just crawling through guts and brains and smoke. People talk about the smell of combat. When you know what somebody's insides smell like and feel like, it does something to you. When you watch war on TV, you're only hit by a couple of senses. If you read about it, only a couple of senses. When you're in it, you find senses you never had. And so those of us who haven't been there, I think, don't know how lucky we are to have been spared that horror. These men know what war is. They know what it's like to hunt and be hunted.
We're going to talk with some of the veterans that you interviewed tonight. And first, I think we're going to hear from a remarkable father and son team, Mike Novosel Sr., Mike Novosel Jr. Before we go to them, Michael, introduce them for us. This was the rarest of father-son matchings. The father served in World War II. They both served in Vietnam. Can you give us a sense of their service?
Mike Novosel Sr. Served in World War II as the pilot of a B-29 bomber. He flew missions over Japan. He was out of the service after the war. In 1964, seeing Vietnam starting to heat up, he thought of John Kennedy's words, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And as he says, I know it sounds far-fetched, but I took those words to heart. And so he joined the Army as a helicopter pilot, thought he'd be doing training. Well, he got sent to Vietnam, and he was placed in a combat role. He flew what was called dust-off, medical evacuation helicopters, which may sound like a pretty safe job. Well, he just was the pilot of a flying ambulance, except that they would land right in the middle of ongoing firefights and take a lot of fire, the idea being, of course, to get these wounded men out and to medical care as soon as possible.
And he ultimately served with his son serving in the country at the same time.
In his second tour, Mike did two tours. His son, Mike Jr., came over. Mike had just finished pilot training, and they were assigned to the same outfit. And they are the only father-son team ever to fly combat together in the history of American warfare. Mike Sr., by the way, is a recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And what's, I think, so interesting is that they are, in a way, representative of all the men in this book, because they are literally war buddies, as well as father and son. The other men in this book are not literally war buddies, but the same idea applies.
Let's turn to them from Fort Walton Beach, Florida. We're joined now by Mike Novosel Sr. and Mike Novosel Jr. Welcome to you both.
Yeah, how are you doing?
We're very well. Thanks for being with us. It's a remarkable story of you both being in the service at the same time. Mike Novosel Sr., let me turn to you first. Did you ever expect at the end of World War II that you might go back to war, in fact, be flying the same kind of missions with your own son 20 years later?
Certainly not. I thought when the war was over that was the end of war for our country, and I certainly have seen many changes to my thought process in that regard.
And when you ended up in Vietnam with your own son there, was this something that you welcomed, or did it bring you fear?
Well, we really didn't think about it. I was rather surprised when he arrived. He asked to be assigned to my unit, and I was asked if it was all right to send him down. And without thinking, I said, well, yes, send him down. I haven't seen him for a year. It'd be nice to see him again. But then I realized, hey, we're going to have to fly together because of the 12 pilots in our unit, the 82nd Med Detachment. Two of us are father and son, so we represented 1/6 of the force.
Now, when you say fly together, does that mean you actually flew in the same chopper sometime?
I was one of my jobs was the unit trainer, so all the new pilots had to fly with me. Well, he being a new pilot, like all the others, flew his first two combat missions with me. We did not have the luxury of aircraft set aside just for training. They got their training in combat.
And Mike Novosel Jr., what was it about your father's experience and telling of World War II that got you interested, that influenced you to join up and get into the Vietnam War?
Well, actually, being around my dad all my life and being around people that flew, I felt that it was just, that's the natural order of things. When you grow up, you go out, you go to flight school, and you go to the military, and that's what you do. I was just absolutely just happy to see him. I mean, you know, we get along good.
And did you find yourself sharing attitudes about war in general, about the Vietnam War with your father, or did you, of a different generation, have a different view of it ultimately?
Well, luckily, he already had a tour over there before I got there. So we're pretty much online together, basically. We both were exposed to the same things, and it really kind of gives you a similar view of things as far as Vietnam goes.
But when you came home, you developed a pretty jaundiced view of politics in particular in Michael Taikoff's book, Brave Men, Gentle Heroes. You're quoted being very hard on politicians. You say, to this day, I feel there's no politician worth a, let's say, a darn. That the establishment, you write, is still a bunch of greedy, self-serving, let's say, bums. Every one of them. And you go right on down. You say, the Vietnam War, the atrocity that they perpetrated on us and on another group of human beings, the Vietnamese, is unforgivable, just unforgivable. Did you have that attitude when you were in Vietnam, Mike Novoselic?
When I first went over there, I went over there with eyes wide open. I went over there with the idea that I'm gonna do everything I can to distinguish, to make a good showing for myself, my family, my country. And I did. I did that. Because as Michael Taikoff said, you know, you work together to help out the guys that are to your right and left. You take care of each other, and you take care of yourself. But I developed that after being awash in other people's blood, and that's all I saw every single day. I went from a guy with his leg blown off to a guy with his arm blown off to a guy with multiple shrapnel wounds all over his body. I mean, you go from horrendous happenstance to horrendous happenstance. You didn't go to pick up some guy in a suit, you know.
Right, because you were flying dust off. So how do you live with those two things at the same time? On the one hand, a complete commitment to your comrades in the war. On the other hand, this deep and bitter skepticism about the motives that drive a country to war, that drove your own country to war.
Well, it's hard to live with. I fight with those snakes all the time, and that is a fact. I still don't have that good of an opinion of them. Nothing's changed through the years. I just see it happening over and over again, basically. And there's no one or anything that could ever convince me that those guys are there for anything but their own personal advancement.
And you're talking about political leaders.
Right.
Mike Novosel, when you look out, Mike Novosel Sr., when you look out at the Iraq War now, you've been through World War II, Vietnam, you look at Iraq, what do you see from your vantage? You're not there, but you're looking on like the rest of us. How does it look to you?
It doesn't look too good. I'm afraid I've seen too much similarity between what happened in Vietnam and what happened in what is happening right now in Iraq. There is an expansion. I witnessed the expansion in Vietnam. I went there when there was only less than 200,000 troops, and then I returned another time when there was 550,000 troops, and there was no real progress being made. Of course, we did the best we could. I was over there to help my country to make sure that everything that was possible to speed up the war, to accentuate our progress in the war. That was my reason for going. But essentially, you have to remember that I volunteered my services not to fight in the war, but to instruct people in how to live in a high-risk environment. By that, I mean how to fly airplanes in combat. I was an instructor in regular aircraft, in jet aircraft, and in helicopters. And I think I was a damn good instructor, and I could have imparted a lot of good information to these young studs. But instead of me instructing, the Army felt that they could use me better as an instructor in the combat theater itself.
And
that's what I did.
And not just a little. You flew 2,435 missions in two tours in Vietnam, evacuating 5,589 wounded. That's a lot of men who can thank you for getting out of what I'm sure were some pretty tough corners.
Well, I believed that I had a contribution to make, and when I go and fight in a war, it doesn't matter if it's World War II or Vietnam, I give 110%. I expect all my associates to do the same.
And Mike Novosel, Jr., your thoughts on Iraq, having been through Vietnam and seen what you saw there, watching the news with the rest of us, knowing, like the rest of us, that the TV cameras no longer show us when the dead come home to Dover. What are your thoughts on what's going on there right now?
Well, very similar to my dad's. I see a quagmire, basically. One or two or three guys a day. You know, to the average Joe on the street, well, it's only one or two guys, you know, that's not bad. When you consider, you know, Normandy or Sicily and those battles, they had thousands killed. Well, over a period of time, it's just as insidious. You know, this right now we're working on 1,400 dead and wounded, 300 dead, of course, but 1,400. You know, put it in perspective. This would fill a stadium up in a medium-sized town twice. Just to put it into perspective, I cringe. I hate to see the young men coming home because I know what they're doing. These young guys and ladies, they're over there just like I was. Their eyes are wide open. They're doing all the right things for all the right reasons. That's exactly, but that's not necessarily what got them there. You know, they went there looking for weapons of mass destruction. And we see how that panned out. Now, they're calling it a preventive action. Preemptive action, the true word is preventive. You know, in international social Darwinism, the survival of the fittest, sometimes you have to destroy the eggs, you understand, so that the adults don't get out. And that's basically what's going on now. And, of course... You've got the leadership right now. While they actually seem to need more troops to help them be safer, the leadership is right now trying to figure out how to get rid of two divisions. It's insane.
Well, there may be more soon, or there may be fewer. It's hard to tell. Mike Novosel Sr., Mike Novosel Jr., thanks for coming on and sharing your stories with us. Thank you for your service.
Thank you. Pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for being with us. Okay. Mike Novosel Jr. and Sr. from Fort Walton Beach, Florida. Michael Takeff, there's a remarkable pair and very outspoken all these years after their service, not afraid to say what they think.
No, the Novosels will tell you exactly what they think, and they're remarkably intelligent and incisive and insightful.
Living next door in matching houses in Fort Walton Beach, Florida now, father and son served in World War II and Vietnam together. We're joined tonight by Michael Takeff, author of Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, American Fathers and Sons in World War II and Vietnam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. On this Veterans Day, we're talking with Michael Takeff. He's author of the new book, Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, American Fathers and Sons in World War II in Vietnam, about two generations of American soldiers, now American veterans. Michael Takeff, I wish you'd just tell us more stories. Give us more examples of the men you talked to, the stories, how they compared between the two wars.
I think one of the interesting things is how people remember their time at war and how it affects how they go about their daily lives. In some cases, the experience of war can really make a person's life afterward full of problems. Richard Resendiz, a combat infantryman in Vietnam from Central California, came home and had terrible trouble adjusting, and as he puts it, his joy of life was taken away from him. He had to develop this numbness to get through every day, to get through the killing, and his taking part in the killing, and his seeing people in his unit get killed. On the other hand, it can affect people in the way they drive a car or in what they eat. One of the most fascinating stories is that of Tony Rivas Sr. Tony Rivas Sr. from San Antonio, Texas, was a seaman with the Indianapolis. And the Indianapolis was taking part in the so-called island hopping campaign by the Marines in the Pacific. The Marines, as most people know, were taking one island after another, going progressively closer and closer toward the home islands of Japan. And the Indianapolis and other ships would provide fire support for those missions. On Tarawa and Iwo Jima, Tony saw bodies floating in the surf, Japanese bodies, American bodies, and he saw small fish feeding on those bodies. He has not eaten seafood since. And what's perhaps most amazing is that when I was talking to the Rivas family, his sons, Tony Jr. and Richard, were there. And the following day, Tony Jr. said to me, I never knew that about my dad, but come to think of it, I never saw him eat fish.
And he didn't know why.
It never even occurred to him to notice it. Here, Tony Sr. was carrying around this memory. It was affecting what he did every day, but he didn't tell the story to this family with whom he shared a table for over half a century. And that's how people are with war. They do not talk about it. And I do hope that if people read Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, maybe they will be motivated to go back to their fathers, their grandfathers, to friends, and to ask them, well, what happened? What was it like? The rest of us would like to sweep these experiences under the rug, but we do ask people to do these unspeakable things and to see these unspeakable things.
And their memories don't go away.
No, and we owe it to them to listen and to understand.
Let me ask you, this was years after each of these wars, and the men you spoke to were clearly of different ages, one generation 20 years or more older than the other. But did you have a sense of whether one or the other came out in better mental health, better spiritual health? Did the veterans of World War II, the so-called good war, carry their war experience more easily, or did it matter years later?
They did carry it more easily, I think, because they carried it more easily to an extent, let's say. Let's not forget, they won the war. They were able to celebrate. After the war, Al Tarbell was made battalion beer and liquor supply manager in Berlin with his outfit in the 82nd Airborne. Mas Takahashi, Japanese-American, after the war, he had very easy duty guarding a bunch of German prisoners, and he was able to take field trips to Nice, to Switzerland, to Rome. He was able to be a tourist over there and to have fun. The people who fought in Vietnam came home. The war was still going on. The American public was becoming more and more disgusted with the whole affair, and we really did not want anything to do with these men, so it was harder for them to adjust. They didn't have that period of decompression. They came home by plane. They often would give in their rifle in the jungle, and then 36 hours later, they were on the street.
And 30 years later, could you see that experience tattooed into their personalities?
Oh, absolutely. These people haven't forgotten it. Some of them have paid a heavy price. But again, let me say that it would be false to suggest that for the World War II veterans, everything was just fine. Mm-hmm. Having gone through what they went through, it stayed with them. Another of the fathers, Ed Jackson, was a gunner on a B-24 bomber in Europe. He was a gunner at the waist, which, of course, is in the middle of the plane. And if I could just tell you what he said. He said, the waist window is just like a big TV screen. You see everything going on. You see fighter planes coming in at you with their guns going. You know they're shooting right at you. You see planes blowing up. You see people getting hit. You see guys bailing out of planes. They don't have their straps fastened. Their chute pops open. They just fall out of it. You see people coming out with parachutes on fire. You see those things day and night after you're away from it. Even now, there are times I see that I can't watch combat movies for nothing. And what is most interesting about that passage, if you go back, it is all said in the present tense. Yeah. It's as vivid today to him as it was the day it happened.
Michael Takeoff, we're going to talk in just a moment with John Howe, who served in Vietnam. His stepfather, Sonny Dunbar, served in World War II. Tell us about John Howe's experience.
John Howe grew up with a real devotion to the idea of service. It was very important in his family. His stepfather, Sonny Dunbar, served in the Second World War, and his father served as well. His father served with the 761st Tank Battalion. His stepfather, Sonny Dunbar, had an experience more typical for African Americans of that generation. Of course, the armed services were segregated during the Second World War, and most African Americans were in support jobs because the powers that be didn't consider them capable of combat and of more important work. But he was in a port battalion. It was not a safe job. He experienced gunfire. And John did grow up with this concept of service. John, during his boyhood, would watch what was called the Brooklyn Day Parade growing up. He grew up in Brooklyn, and it was tied to Juneteenth, the African-American mm-hmm. celebration of the end of slavery. And these units of African-American soldiers would march by, and John just thought, well, that's what I want to be. I want to be a soldier. And he was a very devoted soldier, really approached his job with a great deal of dedication.
Let's turn to John Howe. He joins us from Albany, New York. He was a staff sergeant in the U.S. Army in Vietnam. He's a freelance writer now. His 22-year-old son is a PSYOP, psychological operations specialist with the U.S. Army now, is likely to be going to Iraq. Thanks for joining us, John Howe.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for being with us. John Howe, tell us about your experience in Vietnam. Where were you assigned? What was your job?
Well, I was in two separate units. I was in the 173rd Airborne Brigade, and then later I was in the 25th Infantry Division. During my time in the herd, as we call it, it was at the end of my first enlistment, and I got out of the Army, and then I re-enlisted after I was on the street for a little bit, and eventually ended up back in the 25th Infantry Division, where I really learned about what it meant to be a soldier. I was in B Company, 3rd Battalion, 22nd Infantry, the same infantry unit that Oliver Stone was assigned to.
And you were not drafted. You were a volunteer. Is that
regular
right?
Army.
What was it in the experience of your seniors, your stepfather and others, that led you to think, this is what I want to do?
Well, it was my mother more than my father's. My mother always taught me that it was necessary for us to be very thankful for being able to live where we live. Mm-hmm. And in her family, it had been a tradition of military service. Her grandfather was in the 9th Cavalry. Her great-grandfather was in the 10th Cavalry. And our family goes back to those days at the beginnings of the service by African-Americans in the military establishment. So it's just kind of, you know, it's the thing you did. You know, there was no question about it.
And
you were in the Army.
And how did you come out of Vietnam, John Howe? Did you come out head high and chest out or with reservations? Do you recall? How did you come home?
Well, I came home different than most GIs. I was I was in the regular Army. And I came home. I wasn't discharged immediately, put on the street. I did a tour in Europe, and mm-hmm. I came back, and I was on the street. I was in a unit here in the U.S. And I was very much dismayed as things went along. I remember coming home on leave and being told not to wear my uniform when I got off the plane, that there was trouble with that. I can recall that my wife had difficulty. She wrote letters that talked about how difficult it was for her to go to work where people were talking about how could she support me and be married to a soldier. My mother, who worked at that time at the New York City Board of Education, her hair went from beautiful long or auburn mm-hmm. auburn hair to totally gray, and she talked about how her life was affected every day by the news, the evening news, when Walter Cronkite would come on.
Hanging on each of those news reports.
Yes, hanging on each one of them. And I guess the big thing for my family was, and what made me really concerned, was I was in a photo essay once that was done in the New York Daily News. And my father, my natural father, was riding on a train, and he saw it, and my stepfather was a bus driver, mm-hmm. saw it. And there I was, my picture, my name, everything in the newspapers.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, that really had an effect on folk at home.
You told Michael Takeoff, you said, when you serve in the U.S. military, it makes you part and parcel of American history. It makes you undeniably American. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that people forget, you know, what it means to have service. And my son, John II, said it most prolifically. He said, Dad, he said, I'm tired of sitting around going to – he was in college. He enlisted out of college. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm tired of sitting around listening to these well-to-do little kids who are driving mommy and daddy's BMW and Mercedes and Volkswagens, and they think that everything needs to be handed to them, mm-hmm. that there's no price to pay for freedom. And I think that based upon that, you know, this country is a great country. We owe it, regardless of what we're being treated like. We owe it because of the opportunity that presents itself here.
And are you suggesting when you say that people who don't serve in the military are deniably American, are less than American somehow?
Well, what I say is that it's not necessarily the military, but there are other ways of serving your country, mm-hmm. you know, and the military is only the most visible. You know, you can be a volunteer in service to America in a VISTA program. You can be an AmeriCorps. you can work in an inner-city community. I think everybody needs to take some time from their life and go and do something for somebody somewhere. The military used to be the great equalizer. The draft was the biggest equalizer this country ever had. And without that, we're just, you know, we're just in trouble. People don't understand.
Your son is 22 now, and in the midst of doing just that, he may soon be sent to Iraq. How do you feel about that, John?
Well, I have my trepidations about that. But I know that my son is a resourceful young man. He is very astute. He is very thoughtful, and he's a survivor. You know, he will do well wherever he goes.
And do you think the country's right to be in Iraq?
Well, I've got a lot of problems with this particular war. And I guess the biggest problem I have is, number one, is de facto draft, the way they're doing things. They're mobilizing reservists, which is making the fighting force more aged and more gray than if it had been a 18-year-old draft or a 19-year-old draft, you know, in training. So that's one thing. They're taking in these guys who are committed, to service. They don't commit to necessarily being off the war all the time. And the other thing that I'm concerned about is the fact that we have been told one thing, and that thing has not been yet proven, and that's that there are weapons of mass destruction.
And a soldier likes to have the firm footing of a clear understanding
about why
they're there.
We'll go anywhere, do anything. Just let us know what the real deal is.
John Howe, our time is almost out tonight, but I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Tegeff, we're in the rundown here. Pick up Iraq. You see what's going on there as much as any of us do. What are you anticipating? As you've spoken with all these veterans from World War II, Vietnam, what's in store for the veterans of Iraq, those coming home from Iraq?
We really need to understand what these people are going through and what they will live with the rest of their lives. That's one of the wonderful things, one thing that's so instructive about reading the testimony of these men from World War II and Vietnam, testimony given with the perspective of 35, 55, 60 years after the fact. We really can get a sense of what it will be like for these people who are now young to live with these memories in the years and decades to come. We owe it to them to understand, and we owe it to them not to make the mistake we did with the Vietnam veterans, which is, if this war does not turn out well, to hold them responsible, to blame them. We have to take responsibility for this war. Remember that it's not their war. This war belongs to all of us. If it goes wrong, it is the responsibility of all of us.
And at the same time, you write, civilized people will never be, must never be comfortable with war.
We never should be. The more you learn about it, the more horrible it becomes. John Howe didn't tell you. John Howe spoke of seeing bodies of 400 or 500 bodies in a heap, decomposing in the 120-degree sun. It's just inconceivable to those of us who haven't been there. But these men carry these things around. These are really the stories our fathers didn't tell us, but they have been carrying them around. The veterans of today, the warriors of today, as they become veterans, will carry them around too.
There's a responsibility. Michael Tegeff, thank you for collecting all the stories. Thank you for putting them together for us. And it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Tegeff is author of Brave Men, Gentle Heroes, American Fathers and Sons in World War II and Vietnam. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.